we go ahead and call a meeting in order?
Hold on, we need to unmute the phone so that, I apologize, so that Joy can hear us. Could you unmute that, please? Thank you.
Okay, we'll call a meeting to order. And go ahead and, is there any public comment? Not then, we'll go and has everyone had a chance to look over the minutes of the last meeting on May 3rd? And if so, need a motion to approve them?
I move to accept.
Okay. Hughes makes a motion, and then we need a second. Wait for a second.
A second.
Okay. Cronin. And all in favor?
Aye.
Can I back you up?
Yes.
I think we need to do roll call just so that we have it on record on the tape, if you don't mind. Stacy can do that for you if you'd like. Stacy, will you call roll call, please?
Yes. Dr. Lovin?
Here.
Joy Burke?
Here.
Dr. Hoover?
Here.
Marianne Niemeyer? Jean Schramm?
Here.
Dr. Hughes?
Here.
Laura DeLuca?
Here.
Dr. Malcharek?
Here.
Dr. Frohner?
Here.
And Rebecca Dunn?
Here.
Very good.
Then we'll move on to the reports and... your report there?
My last report in my career for Madison County Health Department. First off, I wasn't thinking I was going to retire the last month when I said we don't need to have a June meeting. Honestly, that decision was made not on the spur, but the timing was right. And so I did make the decision to step down and retire June 30th, leaving at the end of the fiscal year. It actually is easier for the health department, as we have so many state grants and things like that, to not have to adjust budgets and things like that. So the purpose for tonight's meeting was twofold. So I had a chance to say goodbye and introduce the interim health department director, and I'll do that without further ado. Amanda Pruitt over there is the interim director for the health department. The director position has been posted, and I know that the county administration will have that charge and that task of hiring the next director of the health department. I will give you just a little bit of a background from that. That individual needs to have a skill set in public health. It is important, so important, that the state health department actually requires that certifications happen first to ensure that the individual is in fact qualified. That doesn't mean that I'm a rocket or a brain surgeon or rocket scientist or anything like that, but I have 33 years in public health experience, local health department experience, local public health, and it's a different beast. And so I think Madison County is in a very unique situation, having a health advisory committee full of professionals and people from the statute have that fitness for public health knowledge like yourself. So I can hope, and since Kurt's in here, I'll say it, I hope that you all are engaged and involved in the process, the discernment process in some way. It's very important that the individual, whoever that is, at the beginning of this has that knowledge, because for the simple fact that what we really are charged with are core responsibilities out of the local health department, out of the local health protection grant that's governed through the state of Illinois. We have a charge and a requirement to ensure that we have a strong and solid communicable disease, infectious disease program that consists of vaccinations, immunizations, and all kinds of communicable disease follow-up one-on-one. For specific reportable diseases, for the simple fact that... Could you mute your phone, please, Joy?
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. That's really important. From a communicable disease perspective, we're about community health, and our role as a local health department is to prevent the transmission of disease in community settings. So the one-on-one contact that the staff may have as far as nursing goes, or in some cases maybe the sanitarian or the inspector, et cetera, that leads to hopefully arresting, meaning stopping, the spread of a potential disease that's communicable. We have over 100 diseases that are reportable in the state of Illinois that our staff follow up on each and every one of them. Several months ago, you received our annual report, and you could see that there were thousands of communicable disease follow-ups that the health department provided and did. In a lot of ways, a lot of our work is unknown and untouched by most everybody, you know. But if it weren't for, I think, the remarkable, impeccable job that the staff do, you know, I just, you guys have got a gold mine here. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I will miss it a lot. But I know I leave it in very capable hands. I'm excited that Amanda is the interim that will buy you all time to find the right individual to fill this in. You don't need to worry. You know, what interim means in a lot of ways is to keep the boat sailing. You know what I mean? So you have time to kind of dig into this. So Amanda's not going to probably talk and take all this time like I'm doing right now next month, but she might. I don't know. But she'll be working very close with the chairman and with Mary Ann to see, you know, if you want the agenda changed or you'd like something a little bit differently, you know, that will be. But your role is to advise the Board of Health, on matters that pertain to public health. So your input is appreciated, and you get paid a lot of money for this. Let's not forget the $0, which are so important. But you know that nothing goes without impact and preservation, I think, of health and well-being for the county. The health department is 27 years old. It was formed by the TB tax being able to be converted to a public health tax, so that there's a little bit of property tax that goes to support the health department. We are a special revenue fund. So in a month or so, when the budget talks start, and a lot of the debate becomes general revenue debate and dollars and things like that, I'm going to say it. The health department does not pay, nothing to support the health department comes from the general revenue fund. We pay for everything ourselves. We pay our own IMRF. We pay, everything comes out of that special revenue fund. There's three buckets of income, if you will. One is service fees and clinic fees, so that we can bill insurance companies and do things like that for the services that we provide. We can get a little bit of income coming back that way. The second way is through our grants. We manage somewhere between 20 and 24 various grants that amount into over $5.5 million, just off the top of my head, from that. And then the third bucket of income comes from that special property tax. The law sets a maximum limit, meaning that if the county board were so willing and desired to assess our property tax levy up to the maximum rate, the law states the maximum rate, 0.75 mils. We've never been close to that. We've never received anywhere more than, I think it's 3.3 mils is the highest amount we get. So we get about $1.5 million that come from that property tax revenue. But that's important. That, you know, we need that, and that's important. And so in the paper you've seen, I know a lot of conversations about food truck permit fees and all of that the health department committee and the board are currently kind of navigating and going through. You know, just want to understand it comes from really only those three buckets. And so sometimes when you mess with one, you have to adjust the other. You know what I mean? That's that's the way it is. So in the future, I think there'll be a lot of work at hand as far as doing that. The only other thing that I wanted to encourage as I kind of part through this, we belong, the Madison County Health Department has secured membership for what's called the National Association of Local Boards of Health, NALBO. I know some of you maybe have heard of it, but what NALBO is, it's a national association for people like you, for health advisory committee members, for board of health members, county board members as well. And there are great training modules on that website. And Stacy's got you all signed up for it. So yeah. Hopefully you're getting emails from NALBO, et cetera. But there are great training modules. Your charge is really governance. You know what I mean? In that sense of assuring conditions and assuring that programs happen and are in place. Some policy development, in some cases, program development, et cetera. So NALBO is a fantastic association with great training documents for that. So the other division director that I want to introduce is Joni Hall. We've had a lot of changes at the health department. It was all timely because we're working on the I-Plan, the community health assessment. That will be my last action. I will put that puppy in the mail before I leave so that that's not on your shoulders. But when Scott Purcell, who used to be our former director of administration, retired in May, Joni filled that position. So Joni is the new director of administration, division director at the health department. And so those 20 to 24 grants and everything else that we kind of maneuver and, you know, work on, et cetera, Joni's involved in that. In a lot of different ways. So that's really all I have. I want to update you on a few items of note and interest that are just kind of happening. COVID still exists. I know that, you know, it doesn't shock anybody. We are still at medium community status, which means that we're holding our own, if you will. Fortunately, hospitalizations still remain pretty low. Staff, in the sense that hospitals and staff, hospital staffs are not overwhelmed currently. I'm sure they're busy, but, you know, fortunately, we really want to worry about our healthcare systems not being overrun by individuals. So that's good. Cases are up, and we stopped reporting cases and doing that dashboard effect. We ended on May 31st. And the reason for that, there was no, you know, get that off or do anything. Somebody said something to me, you know, and they thought that maybe we shouldn't have done that. But once I explained to them, cases are probably 5 to 10 times higher than what we know that exists because so many people are doing self-test and home test, and they're not reportable. So it's really a false sense of everything and skewing data, et cetera. So we really want to encourage people to stay and look at and focus on those community status indicators, and that's where we are. Several of the northern counties, and there was one southern county, CDC and the state update this every Thursday, are in high community status level, but we're doing okay, you know, in that sense. We've been in medium for several weeks, and we'll just continue to keep a pulse on that. So the diligence is still there. It's still very important. You know, we stay up to date on vaccines. If you're sick, you're staying home. Get tested if you need to get tested, et cetera. The CDC and ACIP several weeks ago did actually approve the pediatric formulations and variations of the COVID vaccine. So that process has started as far as Pfizer and Moderna being administered to basically children under 5. Pfizer, it's under 5. Moderna, it's under 6. The variations of that are really, it's complicated in a lot of ways. And it's really important that people who are well engaged and well knowledgeable with how the various vaccines and formulations work and who needs what, you know, I mean, it's complicated. And I think that's the reason why not a lot of pediatric offices are willing to take it on. So
there's one reason they do not take it on. It's because it's so difficult with storage, and you have the big refrigerators, and can you go over that again?
Yeah, we purchased with the beginning of COVID, we were able to secure what they call an ultra-low temperature. It doesn't sound right. Is that what's coming out of? Yeah, okay. A very, very cold deep freeze. It freezes like into negative 80 degrees. Yeah. So we actually are able to receive vaccine then in that ultra-cold state and keep it that way and hold it that way. And what that does is it allows us to hold on to it longer. You know, frankly, we've worked with multiple doctor's offices, hospitals, other local health departments that don't have access that we're able to, you know, basically help kind of hold that vaccine and get that to folks when they need it and they're ready to use it. By being able to keep it in that ultra-low frozen state, as I said, we're able to hold on to it a little bit longer. And then doctor's offices or whoever, you know, we can make arrangements for them to get that. So that's a very good reason. There's about, I asked staff to look this up today. We have about 6 pediatric facilities, if you will, or, you know, pediatric doctors throughout Madison County. We currently only have 2 entities that are providing that. The pediatric COVID vaccine is not something that you can obtain at a pharmacy. You have to go, you know, the state, the feds, they want you to go to a healthcare provider or your doctor's office to administer that. So for that reason, in our role of assurance, it is important that the health department continue to provide all services as that relates to. I can tell you that we've got, hold some numbers here. We have vaccinated a total of the month of June, just to kind of give you a perspective, because you haven't heard too much about it. From June 1st to today, and it just started last Friday, we've administered 19 doses of the Moderna, 6 months and 5 years or under, and then 5 doses, so 24 doses just since last Friday. So there's a demand for it. There is, you know, folks. As a matter of fact, we have appointments scheduled through July 11th so far regarding that.
Those numbers again, 19 Moderna, and that's 5 and under or under 5?
Moderna is 6 months to 5 years of age.
To 5, okay.
Mm-hmm. And Pfizer is 6 months to 4 years of age, and then they go from 5 to 11 years. I mean, there's different caveats, but a total of 85 people have been vaccinated in the health department in the month of June. The other thing I wanted to report to you, you remember several months ago we talked about the National Kidney Foundation doing the kidney mobile at the health department. We did that last Thursday. We had 20 people come, and this is an incredible statistic, I think. Of those 20 people that were screened, 45% tested abnormal in one or more tests. So 9 of those 20 individuals actually screened and tested in a worrisome way with high blood sugar, high blood pressure, or diabetes. So prevention and screening are really important tools and factors. And I think it went pretty well. Yes, Amanda? It's good that they came. And honestly, I will say this was an effort. They're going across, you know, Region 5, Southern Illinois. They did 2 weeks ago, and then they hit Region 4 pretty hard last week. You know, you only have to go through things once to realize all the things you can do better. It really needs to be better promoted. I mean, there were a lot of services and resources that were there for anybody that walked in. But unfortunately, it was kind of, you know, we had hoped for, it was only a 4-hour gig.
Did you get feedback from them, from the people who came, how they found out about it, or what was?
Can I refer to Amanda? Do you know? Do you have any idea how they found out about it, or?
I can't say I heard.
No. I mean, we had it on our marquee for a bit. There was a press release that went out, not from the health department, but from the National Kidney Foundation, the Kidney Mobile folks, I never saw it get picked up. You know, and we did kind of talk about it a bit too, but I think it kind of lends itself to the importance of, and we're down employees and staff, you know, for this, but it is important to be able to promote and publicize all kinds of different things. And so we learned, and hopefully I think they talked about coming back next year. But I certainly wanted to share that.
But would there be a way to maybe email the doctors in the area or any of the medical groups or any other groups, physicians that could make that available to their patients in?
We could certainly try that. I will tell you that there is, although everyone thinks there is no formal database of doctors and physicians and nurse practitioners and other contracted health workers. There, you know, it is very difficult to communicate.
It's really hard.
It's really hard. So you know what I mean.
Just in the office, I mean, just thinking about trying to get a referral, you're like, oh, they're no longer here. Oh, that nurse practitioner, they used to be. Now they're with this person. Yeah, it's crazy.
It seems like that, though, you're kind of preaching to the people who are already connected anyways.
Yeah. It's
something like
it's almost like if you put it on, like,
social
media.
Talk to a couple
of
grocery stores.
Yeah, social media is the place where it should go. They should be a banner ad or something on social media. That's where people are going
to
see it.
See if a couple of grocery stores, big grocery stores, would allow you to put a poster up for a week. Mm-hmm. This will be happening here.
Well,
because everyone goes there.
Yeah.
And the back of the bus. Yeah.
And really, the addressing of being addressed to address social vulnerabilities, health inequities, and disparate populations, that's also the core of a public health system. And those are the populations and the communities that we really need to be in. You know, pounding the bricks and trying to encourage folks to come in. I mean, there are so many barriers for people that don't necessarily have health care. I mean, in this one, they asked, there was one participant that of the 20 that didn't have a doctor, and there was one participant that reported not having health insurance. You know, so, I mean, that was 20 people. You know, so you extrapolate that. There's a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a lot of work to be done.
And we have no rules against, I mean, we could advertise in a church bulletin, right? I mean, I think that targets certain populations big time.
Or we could really adopt additional strategies and goals to, you know, tie into the other health priorities, you know, that exist around chronic disease and obesity and diabetes and all of those issues that feed into chronic disease issues, and we could really get some more dollars so we can hire some more prevention people to get out there and hit the streets like that. That used to be what it was, you know, but years ago, budgets decrease, grants dry up, and it's very difficult to fund those types of educator types of positions because you have to usually have grants behind it to go. So those are some fascinating topics, I think, as the advisory committee and even the Board of Health eventually could get into and start looking at. And I think those are the types of data pieces that, frankly, Emily should be able to develop and start to bring in, that you are bringing in and have a better idea. What we learned from COVID, no matter what, is that you've got to have data available to be able to measure, you know, where you are, et cetera. I mean, and data can tell us a lot of different things. And we do monthly reports and we, you know, keep track of this and we count this. And but there really does need to be an additional effort put forth in looking at performance metrics and data that can be readily available so that you can really gauge the health of our communities.
Tony, I just have a general question, but why isn't there more education in your primary offices? I mean, is there any way, like with your chronic disease and everything? I know the doctor wouldn't have time to sit and educate somebody on that, but is there any thoughts or movement in getting more health educators directly connected with medical care?
I'm going to let the doctors talk about that.
Well, Go ahead, Paul.
You're the radiologist.
Well, I mean, most hospital systems or medical groups have, you know, they're tied into insurance and they get paid based on how well they take care of chronic disease and their spend and all that. So you know, we hire a lot of navigators, a lot of nurse navigators and other people that are trained to call and follow up with people that have been identified as having chronic illness, because we know that by pushing them, you can keep them out of the hospital and reduce your cost. So there are networks that, so if you're part of a system, usually you're tied into that. They have Epic or they have some big EHR that they can data mine and they can tell exactly who's got what and see when the last test results were for, you know, creatinines or whatever they're following. It's the private docs, the smaller ones, the clinics. Urgent cares don't usually have a really good system for following up on that, and a lot of people go to urgent care for their primary care, believe it or not, or they go to EDs, and there's not a lot of follow-up on that. But I don't know, Paul, anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, healthcare dollar, too. You know, we all want to prevent, it's just, you know, who's paying for that, and that's where it comes from. You know, well, yeah, I'm lucky enough that I'm in an office where we have educators. The other piece to it is, you know, not everyone wants that. Yes, you have high blood pressure. Here's what you can do. Just give me the medicine. You know, that's all I want. They don't want to look at the lifestyle, the dietary changes, exercise. You know, I mean, I had that conversation today with a 400-pound guy that wanted me to fix his underlying condition, where the treatment was the weight loss, but he just wanted
a pill.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So do I.
If there was one, I wouldn't look like this.
Well, I think they get it from, like going to the chiropractor, the dentist. I mean, I try to implement preventive care in the whole facet of the whole health. You know, it's not all one body. And I preach to them a lot and try to implement, you know, the things they can do. But like you said, you know, if they hear from enough people, you know, sometimes it makes a difference. But
and honestly, it's not the ones that are coming to us who really need that education.
Right.
It's the ones that aren't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's honestly where public health comes in. And,
for sure.
You know, that's the National Kidney Foundation. You know, if they're out there and discover some people go, my blood pressure is a little high. It doesn't matter. Other people go, oh, my grandma died from heart disease, you know. It's tough.
And even when navigators call people, they don't, you know, we've had to go through things where we've had to, like, put the doctor's primary number, you know, like, on the caller ID. People won't answer the phone, you know, so that you reach out by the phone and people will just ignore the call, like we all do, you know. I mean, how many times we just, like, I don't know, that spam. But, you know, so then I think we're running, like, you know, most of those systems are running about 20-30% of actually talking to somebody. And then the number of engaged people that they talk to is even lower than that. So, yeah, it's just a communication issue all the way from top to bottom.
And I think it's really going to be a period of rebuilding. You know, COVID has really stopped those interfaces of, you know, seeing people. A lot of people like telehealth because you can, you know, get through so many more and do it. A lot of people don't function well with that. Especially, I've been trying to writing up the community health plan, and you start looking at, you know, the mental health priority, and as that revolves around access to care and even the substance use priority, and again, as that revolves, I mean, there's just simply, it's a lack of resources, and it's just, you know, trying to find what's going to work good for a good number of people. We have a community navigator employed at the health department. It was grant funded, particularly specifically for the breast and cervical grant, and she is doing incredible work. She's been on, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months, but she has brought in so many people that absolutely meet the demographic that we want. You know, people that are unscreened, et cetera. She's just been phenomenal. The state. We're also awaiting to receive notification about a grant. I think I said this at the last meeting. We were one of 21 local health departments in the state selected for a disease intervention specialist grant, and that was basically, again, we haven't gotten that yet to write it up and to actually see the objectives. We're waiting for it. But what that will do is actually be able to fund perhaps one or two disease intervention specialists that, again, will work in that same concept, in that same realm of, you know, some of that outreach and education. So the state and the country, the national, the feds, they recognize that there really is, you know, a resurgence that's needed in that capacity.
Well, I think we all know it doesn't take that much money to prevent.
Right.
But it saves a whole lot of money down the line. The problem is those are two different pockets it's coming out of, you know.
And the feds are trying, I mean, you know, the government's trying to help out. I mean, that's where the whole concept of the Welcome to Medicare exam came in, that when you turn 65, people thought you went in for a complete head-to-toe physical. No, really what it is, it's a verbal assessment, essentially. And you just go through, like, all the risk factors from psychosocial to, you know, to physical to mental to, you know, all in chronic disease, safety in the home. I mean, you know, if you've had one, if any of us are old enough to have that, it's a really detailed, thorough thing, but not a hands-on physical. It's really just assessing for identifying who has critical needs that need to be followed up on. So that's, I mean, we're working there, but it's just very slow to get there.
Do many people reach out to the health department that maybe are in a lower income area or don't have insurance and that to find where the healthcare is available for them?
Amanda, I'm going to let you answer that.
So we serve everyone, you know, regardless of, you know, income or, you know, any of those statuses. But yeah, I do feel like, you know, especially if we have a client that we know and we have a relationship with, they know that nurse and they say, this nurse helped me with this problem, maybe they can help me with another. Mm-hmm. And so we do have often, you know, work with our colleagues for whatever area, if it's not a service that we provide, but we help make that linkage.
Okay. I didn't know, like, if there was any interaction, like, with Southern Illinois Healthcare or...
Absolutely.
What's one in Alton Riverbend, I believe?
Absolutely. Southern Illinois Healthcare Foundation, mm-hmm. that's our federally qualified health center. Mm-hmm. And they actually have primary care services.
Yeah.
The health department is not a primary care clinic, okay? We provide prevention tools, immunizations, screenings. That's what we do, okay? Mm-hmm. So Southern Illinois Healthcare Foundation is actually that line, if you will, to get people who are not insured, who are potentially underinsured, or that simply do not have a medical home. Oftentimes we can get them, you know, tied in because they have all of the specialized services to be able to do that. We work very closely with breast and cervical cancer and general health and well-being, right? Just general services as far as that goes. And vice versa. They refer a lot of people to us because we have, you know, that component of the breast and cervical. I mean, it works both ways. So, we have great partnerships with the federally qualified health centers. Chestnut is also a federally qualified health center.
Does the public reach out to the health department to find out where they can find these services? Or?
I will tell you that the public calls the health department thinking that we are in charge of a lot of stuff. And we are not.
I've been in the paper so much lately.
But here's the deal. You know, somewhere we have to be that safety net, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the beauty of having so many disciplines under one roof, because Amanda may not know what to do about a mold problem. And the health department actually has no jurisdiction about a mold problem in an apartment in the city limits of wherever. But the environmental health staff has a relationship with the city limits of whatever, and the building inspector can talk to them about things like that. So we are very diligent and try very hard to get people hooked to where they're looking for. Sometimes we don't know, and we just have to tell them, I may be sending you on a goose chase, but this is what I would do. We get a lot of those types of phone calls, so-and-so can't take care of themselves, and you need to go in there and, you know, get them cleaned up, et cetera. Well, you know what? There's no laws that tell people how they have to live.
Yeah.
And so in those cases, and again, it can come up, you know, kind of crazy. Sometimes you can get a social agency to the door if you're concerned about the pet not having food or something like that that you can get eyes on and, you know, potentially then help that individual find those resources. So we try to do everything we can do one-on-one in that way. Thanks for asking that question, because a lot of people don't realize that. They kind of just see it one-dimensional, but we're very multidimensional.
And there does seem to be more concern about pets many times than there are
It's unfortunate.
People.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. I'm so done talking. Yeah. Thank you very much.
I just want to say one thing and just follow up on it. Is, you know, you mentioned earlier about the COVID report, and it's really true. Everybody's doing home tests, and, yeah. and you know, I think a lot of us probably in this room have had a positive, home test. I mean, it's just been rampant, you know, like in our network of friends in the last 4 weeks or so. But I think that everyone now, because of the work that the health department's done, that you know, nationally, locally, everyone knows what to do now. You know, I mean, it seems like everybody knows. Okay, I got a positive test. They may not know the days, but they know they need to just kind of shut it down, and you make sure that their family members know that they've been exposed. I mean, I'm just hearing this from everybody I know, and it's like they're kind of doing what the health department was doing earlier with all the contact tracing.
And that was exactly the plan.
Exactly, and that sort of that taught the community what to do, and I think that's a huge pat on the back for the whole system of communication that took place about that, because who knows what it would have been if we didn't know what to do, you know, with it, so... It's kind of running on its own a little bit now.
I should say one thing, because I didn't. I'm sorry, I had a note. I wanted to kind of just say that you can't let your guard down and think that we have a break now. Monkeypox is kind of an interesting situation, and certainly a disease of concern for us. There's been 244 confirmed cases in the United States, 45 confirmed or probable cases in Illinois. There's a whole system in place. We were on multiple phone calls today with the state and the federal folks to be able to run through and work it if we would ever need to respond to that at a local level. I'm here to tell you we can do that, you know, because as it continues to happen, we're learning more about it. Fortunately, that's not touched here. However, we're definitely seeing it now that people are looking for it, you know.
Can you repeat those numbers? How many nationally?
244 confirmed cases in the U.S., 45 in Illinois confirmed or probable cases so far. But
so
we have...
like we're the leader.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
Congratulations.
I think New York and California, this past week, New York and California, both the city and L.A., New York City and L.A., actually... have set up post-exposure vaccination clinics for people that may have had known exposures to sources of confirmed cases of monkeypox. There is a vaccine that is not readily available. You can only get it through the Strategic National Stockpile, and working through that with the State Health Department, that if we would ever need to do something like that here, we could. But you know, turnaround time on a suspected case, you know, by the time you take the sample and have it analyzed, the state's turnaround time is usually within 24 hours right now. That's been an interesting twist, because people are not necessarily going to ERs, you know, thinking that. They're presenting in get well clinics and things like that. And, while it's not a sexually transmitted disease, that's kind of, in some of these cases so far, what we're learning, case analysis, that's what people are thinking they have. And it's ended up to be monkeypox for where, you know, the rash and the blisters are presenting. So there's a lot of unknown and a lot of new with this. And
is the vaccine basically they're using the old smallpox vaccine?
I don't believe it is. Do you know?
That's cowpox. Used that way. This is a step. I think the military, most anybody spent time in the military before, has had a monkeypox vaccine, I think.
And the rate, you know, just numbers I just saw today, the rate's doubling every 12 days. So, I mean, the number of cases, it's a case rate doubling every 12 days. And the RO, you know, the contagious, this one person will infect how many others? It's 2 for monkeypox, 5 for measles, and 10 for COVID. So it's not nearly as contagious, you know, as COVID is, but it's you know, one.
But it's front and center, and you need to know about it, right?
Yeah, World Health Organization did look at it, did not name it as the area of concern yet, but I don't know. There's a lot of people criticizing that, saying, "What did we not learn from COVID? I mean, how long did that was that simmering in Wuhan and all over China before we even found out about it? You know, when it hit Portland or whatever, or Seattle, I forget which city got it first, one of those two, but Seattle, I think it was. But anyway.
Yeah. Now I'm really done.
Okay. Well. Just for a minute, just before we move on, Dr. Mm-hmm. McGranahan, this would be a good spot to just say on behalf of Mary Ann and the advisory board to thank you for
all the
work that you've done and basically run everything for the health advisory board and kept us in line and all the things you've done for the health department. Been there since pretty much the beginning almost.
Thank you. So. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Jump in with another one, and I hope these monkeypox statistics have not influenced Dr. Hughes to move to North Carolina. Upcoming, is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah, we've got a move-in date now, so yeah, it's okay, so yeah. So this will officially be my last meeting. I thought the last one was, but this one.
I do want to say, through the time that I've been chairman, and I've noticed when I've read in the newspapers about whether fleas in this restaurant or something's never in Madison County. You know, I was stunned when I heard the number for the first time, 1,400 restaurant inspections. It's a big job, and something that I will tell you that prior to COVID, we didn't worry. It just was a department we didn't worry about, and that's a testament to Tony and her leadership. Tony's been a great manager. And we're none of us in this room is responsible for COVID, I'm pretty sure. But I just have to say that's a compliment when you have a department. Well, it's like, well, we don't have to worry about that department. And that Tony's been a great manager and has done a great job and a fair manager, just a very skilled manager in all respects. And she's had a good team, built a good team. And so I just, that's one thing that I noticed, and I learned to really appreciate that when there are problems that I read about in other counties, it's not here. And I just wanted to give a big thank you to Tony for that.
Appreciate that. Thank you. You still don't have to worry about the health department.
And now we'll go to Dr. McGranahan.
Oh, thank you. I actually have an interesting article. I'll just submit it for their record in the minutes if anyone wants to read it. It's about the genetically distinct traces of vaccine-derived poliovirus that are in the London sewage system. It's very interesting. And the UK is investigating this cluster of samples that they're finding there in the sewage. So it's just a reminder that, you know, even though polio has been eradicated there since, I think, the mid-80s, maybe 84 or 85, you know, it's still there, and it can come back if we're not vigilant. So I think it's just a great public health metaphor. And I'll just put that, but I just wanted to use just the rest of my time just to publicly thank you, Tony. I was a member of the advisory committee for a number of years, and then I became the medical consultant, so I have sort of an interesting perch because I deal very, very frequently with the clinical staff, you know, like Amanda and everybody else and Patty, and you know, it's that work that they do all the time, and every time I get a text message from them or a phone call or an email, frequently after hours, by the way, when a lot of people just wouldn't pursue these things for their clients or their patients, you know, that's when I get texts. They are so flexible. They are wonderful. You know, they collaborate so well and take such good care of the members, the residents of our county. It's just astounding. And, you know, like we said, it's sort of the best kept secret in Madison County. You know, all this goes on, whether it's getting somebody a rabies vaccine or answering questions about, you know, an exposure of some kind, or, you know, TB patients that are a threat not only to themselves, but obviously the greater public, chasing them down at their home to get them their medicine, you know, trying to negotiate with them, you know, to stop drinking so they can get their TB medicine.
all these things you just never think when you're going to go to school to train, right? You end up doing this. But, I mean, this is all the quiet work that the public never sees, you know, and I'm just grateful that I get to collaborate in the way that I do, but more just, I'm just in awe of their dedication and how steadfast they are, and they're just wonderful. And so, you know, I know that you know, as an interim director, Amanda is going to be wonderful. So I just wanted to express my full confidence in her working with her the way I do on a very frequent basis. So I just thought I'd put that out there. But Tony, the reason I'm mentioning all this about them is they've learned to be like servant leaders from you. I mean, they've never, you know, they've had such a wonderful model in you to be able to watch these years, and just the way that you, it's like all those core tenets of public health, right? And there's Tony, she's checking them all off. She makes sure Madison County has every single one of them, and you know, it's just like they didn't appear out of nowhere. You know, that was your work to get things set up and set the standard, and you know, and so that we don't have to worry about the health department. It just happens. But I'm just astounded all the time when I just get these updates on what's going on and all the work that's done, you know, and it makes our job so easy. You know, it's easy for the clinician just to sign stuff or say, oh yeah, that sounds good. Well, you know, but I mean, I do listen for the record, but I almost wouldn't have to because, you know, they're just so right all the time. You know, I make suggestions, sure, but, you know, if I don't know. You know, I almost feel like, what do you need me for? I'll just say to drink coffee because you guys are so fantastic. But it's true. So anyway, I won't burble on anymore. But I just feel like I really wish that everyone in the county knew how wonderful, you know, Tony and her team are. And I will personally just miss you and professionally. So I just wanted to express gratitude here in the public forum. So thank
appreciate
you, Tony.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, then we'll move on to the new... new business?
Dr. Huber, I'd like to bring up something under new business, but I'd like to hand out, first of all, I have a very smart high school graduate who's helping me doing benchmarking, and if you help us pass this over on this side and this side, pass that out, and I've got some other copies over here. This is just a little, and this is, because it's so new, that the 6 months and up vaccine from both Moderna and Pfizer came out. A lot of discussion about this, but without getting into a lot of additional. So this is some information in terms of where it is available and where it's not available. I learned something. I understand that pharmacists, by federal law, cannot administer vaccines under a certain age. So that's one thing we found out. So the thing that I would like to present before the Health Advisory Board, and your function really is to give us advice, and the county, speak for county board members too, and that is, I think one mention has been that, you know, I have observed, especially in January and February of 2021, people lined up wanting to get a vaccine with fear in their eyes, not wanting any information, just terrified. In fact, they even went to other counties to try to jump the line and get a vaccine before we could provide it for them. And I think what I'm hearing is that maybe it's time to end that cattle call of the vaccine administration. And maybe it's time to restore the patient-doctor relationship so that these little ones, tiny children, can have an opportunity to be evaluated by their pediatrician. And maybe they're different than the other child. And so maybe that's something we should recommend. So A, should we recommend to people in Madison County that before they get this vaccine for the little ones, that they actually have a face-to-face consult with their doctors? And number two, should we require a written direction from a doctor before we administer this vaccine? So the A, number one, should we recommend to, and this comes from talking to other county board members too, should we recommend to the people of Madison County before they get this under five vaccination, should they meet with the pediatrician face-to-face? And then secondly, should we require a written direction? As I understand, Laura DeLuca and her job working with the Pipefitters Union, you don't administer one vaccine without a doctor's direction. And maybe we really need to introduce the physicians back into the process.
We do administer vaccines to the whole, but our medical director signed off on administering the vaccines to the adults. Pediatricians have signed off on administering to the children 12 and up. Under the age of 12, and we've only done a handful of them, probably six of the 12 and up. The ones under that, the pediatricians do not recommend the vaccine for the five and unders. They're not recommending it. And we are actually not giving it to, and we also have one of those ultra cold freezers as well. But they said not. They don't recommend the under five to get it.
So if I could just address that, the one problem I see with this is number one, I know what my office is like. I can only assume your office is running at 100%, 120% at all times. You know, we have patients who want this. We have families who want this for their children. All that's doing, in my opinion, is putting another step, another blockade in front of it. That's not our role, is to perform blockades for this. This has not just been a vaccine that somebody developed out of the back of their car. This has gone through rigid standards and was actually held back for 6 months or more for more evaluation, thoroughly evaluated. I don't see pediatric patients. My wife is a pediatrician, so I guess I can channel my inner her. We've been married long enough. I can do that. But
you can't cook like her.
No, I cannot. Speaking with her, no way would she not recommend this vaccine for a communicable disease that is preventable. I mean, we already talked about prevention. You know, a small amount of money spent can potentially prevent a hospitalization and, tragically, a death.
Well, if I could jump in, what I'm concerned about is really the propaganda that we've been suffering from in this country, where we hear this constant drumbeat of it's safe and effective, and if anything more is said about it, shut up, you're deleted from Facebook, you're deleted from YouTube, safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective. A lot of people have a lot of disagreements with that, and so don't you think that parents need to really discuss this with a physician?
I guess what my perspective would be is that, these are parents who have felt like they've already done their due diligence and they've decided that they want their children to receive it. So it's not a mandate. I mean, these are residents of our county who are satisfied themselves that they would like to proceed. So I just wouldn't like to see another barrier, between them and their private choice. That would be my thought as a pediatrician. And I mean, we do answer a lot of questions, so it's not like we always see the patients, but we'll do a telehealth visit or answer a phone call. But I mean, we definitely encourage parents, here's the information, and they do what they, what they want to. There's a fair amount of demand in our office. We started just this week with our vaccines as well, and we're booked through probably mid-July now for vaccine slots. But, so there's a fair demand. But at the same time, I've had a lot of conversations with other parents who, they just have questions. They want to think about it. So that's great. That's the way things are supposed to work. But at the same time, I think if a parent's decided that they do want to receive it, and maybe they don't have a primary care doctor or their doctor is overwhelmed and doesn't have slots for them. If they do want to come to the health department, I don't know. I'm just uncomfortable with the idea that there's a barrier for parents who have made a decision for their child, and then there's this bureaucratic hurdle, that's put up in front of them. I don't believe in a mandate for it at all. But on the other hand, if a parent does want it, I feel like we should make it as easy as possible for them.
And even making it easy that's three places where you can go get it.
Yeah, I mean,
the entire Madison County. Yeah, I mean, it's not.
Yeah, that's true.
And,
that's true.
You know, when you look at that assurance piece of what public health is.
Well, and, you know, and a lot of patients whose parents are more in a position, you know, socially and economically and everything to be able to make multiple trips or take off work and come talk to me or do a telehealth visit, you know, that's great. You know, and they'll come and we'll give them the vaccine at our office. But you know, there are a lot of other folks who, you know, doing like a second visit for them is a significant barrier because of time off of work or school or just logistics or whatever. So, you know, I don't know. I just would hate to see that somebody who wants that for their child can't get it because
Should the health department recommend to folks in Madison County that they have a face-to-face consult with their doctors for these little children? These are questions from the county board.
Sure, yeah.
And that's what you're here today to advise.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Would that be a healthy recommendation?
I think it's always good for every patient of any age to have a medical home and a primary doctor. So, yeah, I mean, and that's one of those public health functions is the linkage, you know, to link residents to a medical home. I agree with that. We've been through this period of time, face-to-face, one size fits all. Versus a phone call. I mean, I'm just trying to think. Where now isn't it time to return that
patient doctor? And some folks have said, it's, you know, back in January and February, we felt like we were in an emergency, and that's why people were so afraid. Mm-hmm. They were lining up. But no, we're not there. I don't think we have that level of emergency, so I think people can take that opportunity. I mean, I'm just thinking, is that something would you recommend that to people to see their physicians before giving vaccines to children under five?
I wouldn't want that to be a barrier if they don't already have a medical home. You know what I mean? Like, so I think if they made the decision that they
just a recommendation,
want to have COVID. Yeah, a recommendation, sure. I mean, absolutely, yes.
But not a mandate, right?
Because so I think mandates either direction are not you know.
So
I have
the option to come again.
But I do, yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of linking someone with a medical home where they feel comfortable talking to their doctor, yes, absolutely. I mean, they see the health department for that, or whether it's a flu vaccine or whether it's tetanus or whatever, sure, absolutely. I would never, I mean, you know, it's what I do, so sure, I'd love that. People come and have a medical home. I mean, that's good for prevention everywhere.
Yeah, but my first thought is, you know, like before you give any of these vaccines, I mean, there's a question and answer period. I mean, there's the nurse who, because like, how do you do it? I come in with I've got my 7-month-old, and I say I'd like my baby to have a COVID shot. What would you do?
We have a set of contraindication checklist questions that we ask, and we go over the vaccine information sheets, and one of the questions we usually do ask is about a medical home because we do feel like that's really important. If that way we can make that referral right away if they don't. So, yeah, they always have a little consult with the nurse. We go over the contraindications, we go over the VIS, and do all that before we administer anything.
Right, and you answer any questions they might have. Mm-hmm. So they're getting a face-to-face. I, you know, the question, I guess, is with a doctor because, you know, NPs now and PAs are seeing, you know, the majority of our primary care patients, it seems. So, I mean, I don't know where you draw the line. So then what about a nurse, you know, in the clinic that's doing the same exact role under the auspices of a doc? I mean, it's technically you, right? Aren't they working under you?
Yes.
So they're getting a doctor's oversight through the staff. So I agree. I don't think putting barriers to say it has to be a face-to-face, that mandate is going to just inhibit so many people from doing something they really would like their kid to have. I think it's hard enough to get them in for school physicals, you know, let alone then making them do another visit and take off, like you say, take off work or whatever they have to do for it. It's not like they're just going up and saying, give me a shot, and, you know, here's your Big Mac and here's your shot. It's like, you know, you're going through a whole step of procedures. They're signing off on it. They're giving off their, you know, it's informed consent, which I know has been huge for all of us here, we've...
They're no longer offering Krispy Kreme donuts.
But I just think as long as you're face-to-face with someone to answer questions, I don't really care who that is as long as they're authorized and capable of doing it.
And I do think a medical home is so important, though. I completely agree with that. Yeah. I mean, in terms of prevention and counseling...
If this helps encourage somebody to get a medical home...
But 25% of the U.S. does not have a primary care doctor.
It is, and that's 25%. That part is very frustrating. And you know, so... Yeah, I think the recommendation, you know, just any encounter with personal health services in the health department, if that's one of the things, and I know that's largely done anyway, I know it is, but yes, I mean, emphasizing that, absolutely. I mean,
So what is the current, for those under five, how many kids are you seeing, like what are we treating with the vaccine with under 5-year-olds?
I'm sorry, like how many...
Oh, and just like the whole risk to benefit. I understand the CDC pushed their thing through, and you say it's been vetted, and we've had lots of tests. Primary outcome, the study, to my knowledge, it was based solely on antibody levels. They didn't even have symptomatic as an endpoint because there weren't enough symptoms. And I mean, I know that the last 3 months, I don't know that I've seen a positive CT or radiograph on COVID, even among adults. I mean, it's just... gone. I know it's rampant in the community still, but
the severity
is, right. It's a completely different disease, and the vaccine is still a vaccine to the earlier variants, which aren't even here, so I'm kind of like, what is the game? What is the push? I understand. Do people really understand this?
Really, I personally think that's a really good question. I know I'm kind of the outlier here, but you're right. As far as I know, there are no studies that demonstrate that children getting vaccines keeps them out of the hospital. The only studies that we have are looking at antibody production and the development of perhaps COVID later on. But I agree with you. I think that there are plenty of reasons for families or parents to have conversations with their doctors about this, because in my mind too, I think that there's still questions. I don't think that anything's clear cut. I still think that this is very new. We have no long-term data to support the safety profile of this, and for me, a blanket statement of this is just safe and effective without talking about we really don't know is not...
Well, how do we know even that signal? I mean, we have, the drug companies have done their studies. They reported to the CDC. And then they don't even make the data available. They've gotten rid of their placebo groups, to my knowledge. So how do we get long-term? The last 2 years have given me a lot of things to be a little concerned and skeptical. There are lots of red flags that pop up and just make me think, just in terms of my children or other people, what I would do. But then when we're talking to provide the community, again, it still comes back to me, what are we treating? What are we... preventing amongst 5-year-olds.
Are we preventing? Have we ever had 5-year-olds?
I think that's a study that's a 5 and 10 year outcome. But we have not had that time in the last 2 years. You know, 5, 10 years, COVID-19 may not be around. I think some of this has to be trust in science. And, you know, I think there's...
Science is verified, though, not just trust. Yeah, well, right. The CDC telling you.
But it's also builds upon itself. You know, we talked about this. I think Dr. McGranahan brought this up. You know, it's a progression. It's what we have now, and that's what we have to treat. Prevent. And I think treat is the wrong thing. You know, will this prevent hospitalizations? Well, if you extrapolate adult data, yes. You know, hospitalizations are down because of changes in variants, everything. And just like this mutated into a severe disease, this will mutate out of a severe disease also. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of a virus.
May have already.
But, I guess I see the cattle call. I don't think we're doing that anymore.
No, that ended last July.
At that point, we were. And, was informed consent there? Yeah, the stuff was there, but I don't think people cared.
That's what I think is the cattle call aspect, is that you still have the mainstream media pounding and pounding and pounding. Get the vaccine, get the shot, get the shot, get the shot. And the antidote to that is a face-to-face visit with a skilled pediatrician to get a fuller understanding and not just this pounding.
So number one, your face-to-face is not going to always be with a skilled pediatrician. Right. It's going to be, as Lauren said,
or
the a skilled nurse practitioner. You know, so we have to watch that. There aren't enough pediatricians or family doctors to see every kid in the States. But, you know, I think just like the choice not to take the vaccine for these families who want the vaccine, I think that choice needs to be there. And not having that, I think, is as much of a crime as forcing people to get it and mandating that way. Again, I don't agree with mandates either.
What do we do with other vaccines for children?
Well, I mean, if you look at the numbers of studies and the numbers of vaccines, people vaccinated prior to them being authorized and used, it's extremely small. The hepatitis B, hepatitis A vaccines were 500 people each.
No, I meant in terms of, like, for parents going and bringing their kids in, I want this vaccine, I want that vaccine, I would like this.
It's a school.
Got the pre-approved ones, but like, say someone wants, well, I'd like hepatitis B for my child, or I'd like something else. Can you just go to the health department? Like, what is our... Mm-hmm.
If it follows the schedules.
Sure, if it follows the
I mean, we have approved schedules of vaccinations.
Yeah, you can't.
And they have alternative, there's alternative schedules if there's this or that. But getting to your questions about what are we preventing, I mean, I've got some numbers here. So this is with Omicron data. So this goes from January through March. There were roughly 14,000 plus hospital admissions of kids under the age of 5. 90% of them were unvaccinated children, which they would have been at that point in time. So 90%. So that's what they're guessing. And then they look at adult data, they see that just plummeted with vaccinations. So they're extrapolating, like Paul said, that hits the adult. With deaths, since COVID started 2 years ago, we've had 444 deaths of 5-year-old and under that we've seen here in the country. To put that in perspective, we have no problems at all with DPTs and DTs. You know, everybody gets a tetanus. Anybody have any idea how many deaths a year we've had with COVID or from tetanus? They're less than 8. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. for the last 15 years, we've had less than 8 deaths a year from tetanus across the whole U.S. So we've had 444 kids die in the last 2 years of this infection. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, having a vaccine available, even if there's a few questions about it, we're talking about a magnitude of severity here, even though it's rare. If that's my kid,
Do we know how many of those kids had any underlying?
A lot of them had underlying conditions, but they would not have died if they hadn't had COVID. They wouldn't have died died, but most would not have died if it weren't for COVID.
But I think we're still talking about COVID as one disease, and these are completely different diseases. I mean, COVID, the first year, even Delta and Omicron are completely different. And we also have now a population where pretty much everyone's seen it. And in addition to having different disease, you have a vaccine that is for a virus that's no longer here.
Everyone's seen flu. Dr. Hughes, take care, bud.
Is that Joy?
I think so.
Yeah, Joy wants to say something.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment, and this is related to adults who have been vaccinated, the sudden adult death syndrome that we're seeing that seems to be, you know, popping up right here in the middle of, COVID land. This is something that we're seeing directly after COVID has come through. People are fully vaccinated and they're coming in, finding 40 years old who have sudden death syndrome. And many of the times they have heart inflammation. We know that is directly correlated with the vaccine. These are things that are we willing to say for these children that without their a pediatrician seeing them, that we're willing to say, yeah, it's worth that risk so that more can get vaccinated because we want to say that, you know, that this is going to prevent them from getting COVID, which we have seen is much less severe with children. Those children who do have severe underlying health conditions like type 1 diabetes or even type 2 diabetes, that those kids are much more susceptible to any kind of thing, you know, any to the flu, to all these other communicable diseases. Are we just going to say that they shouldn't see a physician to be able to evaluate that? It's, many times they do have a pediatrician, and are there alternative places where they can see a pediatrician that would offer the vaccine to them that they can see a doctor face to face?
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, what is it that you think the physician will be able to add to the screening and the parents who made up their mind, not made up their mind, or, you know, other than to, you know, as you said, there's maybe some questions yet that we're not sure about, but we'll, there's no way of being sure about it because it's not been around that long. So what else would the physician be able to add to that?
I think the whole idea, I think the whole idea, and I, you know, I don't know, maybe you guys are right as far as, you know, mandating it is maybe not the way to go, but at least, you know, suggesting or having a recommendation that for a young child to, it, you know, recommending for them to speak to their primary care doctor about, have a more detailed conversation than what they are just hearing from the news or from their friends. I think that and I don't think anybody would, you know, like we're all saying, recommending anybody to speak to their doctor just to make sure that there truly is informed consent. I don't think anybody would, you know, think that that's a bad idea. But I do think talking to your physician, if you, you know, there's a difference between just hearing something on, you see something on the news, this is safe and effective, and I think Kurt's right. I mean, in general, that's all you hear. This is safe and effective. It's recommended now. Go and get it. That there's a lot more that could be talked about beside just that blanket statement. And so I don't think a recommendation
would definitely encourage people to communicate more with their medical people. That's true. But I think if a recommendation came out from the health department that you need to speak to your pediatrician, that there people would take that as an implication that there's some concern from the health department about this since they're recommending that.
Maybe, or maybe that would kind of counterbalance the fear that a lot of them have of COVID in the first place, which is really kind of what the media is saying. Be very wary of this. Be very fearful of this. You need to get your kid vaccinated because, you know, they're going to die if they don't get this vaccination. And I think that's what these parents are taking away from, some of them are taking away from this. And it might temper, you know, so that the physician may be able to say, or the nurse practitioner or whoever, you know, yes, it's a concern, you know, you can, here's some more information.
Right.
And it's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, recommending somebody to make sure that they feel like they have all the facts and they don't have any questions before they administer it to a young, you know, baby toddler. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
It's a very vulnerable group. Even with adults, because, yes, people know, oh, I want it, but you also have a population where certain people thought that if you got COVID, you had about a 40% chance of dying, which is wildly inaccurate, and that's among adults, and that's not even children. Yes, there may have been 400 people in the country, but, I mean, 400 people in the country is not a staggering amount. And we're also talking about disease. Again, these are different diseases, and I know you can extrapolate from adults to children. Then you're also extrapolating a disease that used to be that was more serious to now. You start to extrapolate to, well, now you're guessing. And so, yeah, people have firm ideas, but it's like it is still somewhat of an experimental early on. We don't have long-term studies, and we're kind of giving it an imprimatur of, well, this is, again, safe and effective, and so I don't know what the proper is. I mean, that ship kind of sailed.
Yeah.
And I don't
know. Well, it has. I mean, and, you know, in terms of what we're treating, I think it's important not to overlook the data from centers like St. Louis Children's. I mean, you have, like, 85 to 90% of the kids that were, and this is age 12 and up, that were admitted with either MISC or cardiomyopathy in the PICU, you know, they were unimmunized. So You know, and this was week after week after week after week during Delta and the early part of Omicron. So, you know, that's very, very strong. And that is duplicated in centers all over. I mean, you have the work from Jason Newland of Infectious Disease at Children's, and they're, you know, they're aggregating this data and they're showing that. So, I mean, that's very, very persuasive, you know, and so part of it is extrapolation. I mean, it certainly is, but it's very reasonable, you know, and again, we're not going to have long-term data. So we either do nothing or we just go to war with the army we have. And that's where the discussions are important, because you have to be honest with people and say, look, there is no long-term data. But, you know, I'm going to give you the pros and cons, and as the parents, you know, that's where we have to trust that the parents are going to evaluate this, and they'll decide what they feel like is best for their child. But if they feel like that they want that, I just don't think that we should tell them, well, you know, you can't because you haven't had a face-to-face with me or whatever.
This shouldn't be mandated.
You know, they should. I would say, like, if you look at the outcome in terms of, like, MISC, and also there is long-term COVID in children, and there's a lot of other things like that that, you know, extrapolating from the adult data and from the data in teens, that, you know, that can be, the risk for that can be greatly mitigated if you're immunized. So, I mean, it's not like we're not treating anything, and I think that's important. The other thing, too, you know, that Joy mentioned, that about the sudden adult deaths, you know, that the papers that have been published on that are actually after hospitalizations for COVID infection. This is not from just the vaccine. These are not adults who have just walked around, got the vaccine, and then had sudden death. That data was from patients who were admitted to the hospital, and then in the year following that admission, had a much higher rate of sudden death than their age-matched peers who had not been hospitalized for COVID. So I think that's important. I mean, I would not want to create the impression that, you know, if you just get your vaccine at Walgreens, then you have a much larger chance of dying in the next year.
I want to jump out at another point, you know? And that is an emergency use authorization. Mm-hmm. This whole concept came into being at the very end of the Obama administration, and it was predicated on a couple of different things. Number one, Pfizer and Moderna have absolutely no liability. Okay, mm-hmm. People need to know that. Mm-hmm. And if there's an adverse event, you're out of luck. Mm-hmm. Okay, number two, and you're affecting your child for the rest of your life. Number two, do we have an emergency? I'm just posing that question. Mm-hmm. Number three, the whole you get these vaccines or so-called vaccines, which are totally different than any other vaccine that we've seen. Produced by Operation Warp Speed. Now, I'm a Republican. I didn't think that was a very good idea. But but now you also have the idea that these vaccines have to be, okay, we created a new word, effectivity or effectiveness. They have to be effective. Effective for how long? The good data in Israel showed that it fell off, it declined in about 6 months, and so you needed a booster because it only worked for 6 months. This after two shots. And
well,
so that's not
that's
very
part
effective.
Of, that's part of, well, actually, yeah, everything, I agree with everything you
and
said.
And when you think, when
that,
normal people think of a vaccine, they think of a vaccine being effective for a long period of time. That's what, and so that maybe we're
well,
not even using
well, no,
the
not
right
necessarily,
word.
Though, because we have annual flu vaccines, and the flu virus mutates every single year. So
I would say that's one
exception. But it's a pretty powerful exception. I mean, there are tens of millions of those vaccines given every single year, so... I mean, that, you know, there's very good precedent for that. The other thing I think is that we have to look at the opinion polls of the American public at the time that President Trump and HHS were doing Warp Speed. Like 80-90% of the public were demanding a vaccine. They were angry that there was nothing that was showing up. I mean, you remember that Fauci was getting grilled by all these people. Where's the vaccine? How you said 3-4 months? How come there isn't a vaccine? And the American people were demanding it. And so, you know, now we have it. And now everyone's like, oh, this is dangerous. We don't want it. You know, and I understand that. You give people what they say they want, and then they don't want it. And it's human nature. It's sociology. I understand all that. But I think we have to understand, like, we're looking with the benefit of hindsight. The American people wanted a vaccine. I mean, they wanted that. So, you know, this method, which was not new, was used. And, you know, if you look at all of the data so far, and again, we've never had long-term data right when you start a vaccine, obviously, but we didn't for polio, we didn't for measles, we didn't for any other vaccine, cholera, nothing.
you know, so that's what we had. And again, you know, Donald Rumsfeld always said, you know, you go to war with the army you have, and it's true. You know, so I can certainly understand if people feel like a vaccine, the risks are out or do not outweigh the benefits. I completely understand that. But on the other hand, I think that the part of the public that wanted it, you know, I think the government worked with private industry to provide what the American public wanted.
I think that with Warp Speed, that the advantage was the government would pay for the risk. We will pay you to produce it all ahead of time, so we take out all of the little time, you know, wasting steps. But I think the expectation of the public was it still would go through reasonable channels of checking for effectiveness, checking for safety. And it still boggles my mind why it's so difficult to get this primary data, and why would you get rid of placebo groups? And there are just tons of red flags coming up, and the people who are doing the watching supposedly seem to be already on board. So it's like, well, who's really doing the oversight? If you're not allowing physicians and the public, you know, the scientific public, to actually see your data, well, I'm basically trusting Pfizer or the CDC, and they seem to be pretty much operating the same. So,
suggesting we can't trust Pfizer?
From an outsider sitting in, I really appreciate this dialogue. You guys are amazing. Just listening to you, the wisdom is going back and forth.
I'm joking.
You know, the thing that's odd for me is...
I was going to make a comment about that early rollout of the vaccine, is that when the vaccine was rolled out, that it was not offered first to the people who were most at high risk, people who were locked up in nursing homes, and people who were in that age group that they were dying. It was offered first to healthcare workers. And the healthcare workers already had PPE. We did have it in the hospitals. But the patients, the people who were dying at the highest numbers, that vaccine was not offered to them. They had to wait for at least a month or longer before that vaccine made it to them. So that was something that was also a red flag to me, that, you know, why are we warp speeding this, but we're not treating the people who are dying in the highest numbers? And those were the people who were asking for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. Just one thing from the media. Measles currently are not a threat. So what do you tell your parents about getting measles if they say, well, the measles aren't around hardly anymore?
Oh, sure. You know, basically, I mean, we just present the data. I mean, you know, every year around the world, you know, you have, you know, what, 100,000, 200,000 deaths per year on the planet from measles. We don't have them here.
Is that because we're vaccinating?
Because we're vaccinating. We do have periodic outbreaks, though. I mean, if you look, you know, we have periodic outbreaks, you know, like whether it's, you know, one state here, or Pennsylvania here, or Minnesota there, or Oregon there, whatever. You do have them, you know, and I think that's part of it. And the other thing I will add to historically, you know, the whole phrase trust science is that drives me crazy, because you're right. There's too many people that are acting selfishly.
Science isn't about trust. It's about verification
and
repetition.
Yes. And that's exactly it.
Well,
I completely agree.
It's not about deleting people off YouTube channels.
It's not.
But that has happened in spades in this country.
Yes. And I guess the only thing I would say is that, no, and I agree with all of that. I absolutely do. What I would say is that, you know, this, the way that the vaccines have been rolled out, you know, for the last 60 years in this country, there has not been one vaccine that has been successful in its first few years, that then 20, 30, 40 years later, there have been some long-term complication that's popped up. It has never happened. So there must be something to the method that is effective. The VAERS system is very good, because it caught the Rotatec vaccine in the late 90s that was for the rotavirus, you know, and they saw some complications with intussusception. The VAERS system, it flagged it because, you know, people called in. They said, look, you know, we've had these complications of our patients, and it was a combination of parents and medical providers and things like that. And so that was removed from the market, but that was right away. I mean, that was within a very short period of time. So all the other vaccines, though, you know, like polio, measles, tetanus,
I know that
all
you've, I know that you've looked at the VAERS information for COVID. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I know that what is put in VAERS is not... All of the data in there isn't all finalized and followed up on, but the difference in the amount of adverse events that are reported for for COVID versus all other vaccines that we've been giving for decades. I mean, you can look at the, you know, you can look at the spikes here. I mean, I mean, you can look at all of this, and I know that you can't say, well, that is all true and accurate, but you're bringing up the rotator. I mean, if you're looking at that and you're seeing huge spikes, I think it should make everybody at least take a step back and say, well, let's think about this for a minute here.
Well, sure, but I think the difference with that, though, is there's never been a vaccine that's had this much social media attention. There's never been a vaccine like introduced in this environment during a pandemic, and there's never been, as a result, so many people paying attention. I mean, no one was paying attention to Rotatec. I mean, it was just, you know, you had a few families. This was before the internet, really. I mean, you know, and so the VAERS system, it worked. But I mean, here when the data has been analyzed out of the VAERS system, like for myocarditis as an endpoint, it hasn't been found, you know, to this time that it's significant risk, you know, versus certainly getting myocarditis from COVID infection itself.
It has been found that it increases the risk over the general population.
Well, only if you look at it in a vacuum, but not if you look at it in the context of people who actually, you know, catch COVID. So, if we say that there's no COVID, you know, would you take this vaccine because your risk of myocarditis is going to be more than someone who didn't? Well, of course. I mean, you wouldn't do that. But then you'd never get the flu vaccine if there weren't flu either. So, you know, you have to look at the risks versus the benefit. But the risk has to include what's the chance that you'll get a very severe episode of myocarditis and end up in the PICU if you get wild-type COVID. You know, so I think
that's the biggest thing right now. I mean, we really need to sit down and evaluate the potential benefits at this point versus the potential risks. And you're right. In both of those categories, there's still questions.
Oh, you know, there are. But I think the VAERS data has to be vetted. And, you know, the reason that you can have a huge spike, but I mean, I could
why would
gin
you
up
not
a bunch
see
of,
a huge
you know,
spike in any of the other, and all of the other
because there's no controversy about the other
given,
vaccines, that's why.
But we've
Nobody
been giving those
that.
Vaccines for decades.
Exactly.
We've only been giving this vaccine for 18 months.
Right.
And to see the discrepancy, in my mind, it makes me take a step back. I mean, that's all I'm saying.
I agree with the reflection. I appreciate your point, too. Like, obviously, it's become politicized, and so people are more aware and whatever else.
Sure.
And again, with myocarditis, yes, if I mean, postulated that it's maybe from the spike protein, and if you're immunizing with the spike protein, it's maybe not surprising that you have it.
Sure.
And that if you actually get the disease, maybe you have more, and you'll also get, and, you know, my sister makes this argument to me all the time. It's like, well, if you get it either way, at least this one protects you. That's all well and good if you're the immune-naive child. How many children have already had COVID now at least once? I mean, probably 90%. All of mine have had it twice. I've had it twice. My daughter, who's 8, has still not gotten it. I've tested her each time we've all had it, and she's never gotten it. I think, but again, we make little leaps of faith. Well, is it the same for children as for adults? Is it the same for people, kids under 5 as opposed to over? Does having extra antibody levels actually mean the same as reducing your risk of myocarditis or anything else being symptomatic? Is the disease and you know, the numbers of deaths and everything else from the early virus versus what we have now, is that the same? I mean, all of these things, are we treating kids, encouraging vaccines now to kids who've already had COVID? And yes, maybe getting COVID gives you just the same risk of myocarditis, but maybe every time you give someone something, you have that same risk of. I mean, why would you, is there any benefit, again, is what I'm asking. Like, what is the true benefit today for children under 5 to take a vaccine that, yes, it's early, and in the teeth of a pandemic, you take risks that you might not otherwise, but are we still at the same state where we were 2 years ago where, you know, 3% of people were dying, kids were getting it? I would say we're not. Does that behoove us then to, hey, let's go back to more normal reevaluating things, talk to your doctor. It's not an emergency. You don't have to necessarily get this right away. You've already had COVID. Maybe it's not. I mean, which, yes, people make their own decisions, and they should, but have we done a good job in actually educating people in what the true risks and benefits are? And are we just giving it a rubber stamp saying, yes, this is all hunky-dory. I mean, I'm not giving it to my daughter who's 9. I don't see any reason to. She has no comorbidities. She's already been exposed to it 3 times. My wife had COVID once. I had it the second time. We all got it again a month ago. None of us have gotten really sick. She's the least susceptible. She's had no symptoms and didn't test positive any of those times. So she's clearly been exposed to it. She's been around us the whole time.
Had antibody levels that were not detectable?
I haven't detected antibodies.
Maybe she had it first.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But there will be. Yeah. But like, why would I want to vaccinate her? I don't see the purpose.
Yeah.
And frankly, my faith in drug companies and everything else has cratered in the past 2 years.
Absolutely. And that's actually a good point. But if you have someone who, I agree with all of that, all of it. I guess I would offer that, if you have someone who has a 6 or 7 month old baby, there's a good chance that child has not had COVID of any kind. You would want to protect them because, you know that we don't want them to get long-term COVID. You don't want them to get MISC. So for them,
you don't know the risk.
You can
we cannot say right now, the only thing I feel like we could say, I mean, I understand that there's a risk of MIC. There's a risk of death. But there's a risk with any. We're talking about influenza. I mean, any child that gets influenza or gets any kind of, enteroviral infection could end up with meningitis. I mean, there's a risk to everything. And not knowing for sure that me giving this 6-month-old this vaccine that could have potential side effects, not knowing that would prevent a hospitalization or prevent the MISC, I don't feel like I have enough data to really create a strong argument for parents to just one way get the vaccine.
Well, and there are other things also we haven't even considered at all. I mean, these vaccines are delivered intramuscularly, so it's basically a blood-borne vaccine, whereas when you get the infection, it's through the nasal airway. So you have totally different, or not totally, but very different immune responses. One's more IgA, IgM mediated, the other's IgG. If you give a vaccine, you're giving it again to a virus that's no longer in existence, you do also then, the next time you encounter it, you don't necessarily form the same immune response. Are you predisposing someone to an immune response to a virus that's no longer even here and preventing them from, developing a proper immunity to subsequent infections with viruses that mutate, both on the individual basis, but then you also have the same concerns on a population basis. Anytime you vaccinate with just one variant, are you now... But all these are questions that I don't know answers to, but... Are they being studied? Are they even being looked at? Or is this all just this push, vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate?
Well, and I mean, there's also obviously clinical trials now for the Omicron-specific or more specific, vaccines. Those are underway and have been for a while. But I do think it's reasonably, and no parent should ever walk away from a counseling session feeling like, there's no question about it. But, there's never, ever been a vaccine launched with long-term data, by definition. There's never been one without questions. There has never been one. So
it usually does take a decade. Before you nationally.
The other vaccines that we've had, though, I mean, they haven't been tested on as many kids even as the COVID vaccines have. So, if we really look at the data for approval for these vaccines that have been shown to be safe and effective over decades, the numbers of children in those trials would probably surprise most people if you actually looked at them. And I'm not saying that, we have a vaccine mandate. No. I mean, a parent should always, always make the decision. But I think it's very reasonable, given that the data we have about MISC and long-term COVID and everything else, to be able to present it to parents and say, there's a lot of data and suggestion here from PICUs and neurologists and everybody else that this, it's good to not be naive to this virus if you get it, and even the antibody levels are not the end all be all, because some people have antibody titers that crash down to nothing, like the Israeli data. But then when you're confronted with the virus, you ramp up an immune response very quickly. So even looking at that, you can't say that you're not, you don't benefit from it long term. You're not immune because your B cells do remember. So even then, I mean, yeah, so I think we have to say there's a lot of questions, you know, but at the same time, you know, it's very reasonable to look at the data and the experience 2 years in and say, there's a lot of potential benefit from this, and if your son or daughter wants it, then we should offer it, but we should
for the naive individual.
We should never.
But what about for kids who've already had it a couple of times?
Well, yeah, that's more of a question. I mean,
because that's also not being given out to people. It's just like, oh, you need to, because we've been telling adults, it doesn't matter. Natural, you know, like for 2 years we've ignored the fact that once you've had it, you do actually have immunity, and it's a robust immunity, not just to spike protein, but also capsid protein. You've got T cells. You've got it. I mean, it's a completely different beast. And we've completely ignored that and still pushed vaccine. Get your booster. I'm like, I've already had it 3 times. Why would I want a booster? And, I mean, that's for everyone. So when you have it with the kids, too, I mean, does a parent really need to get their child vaccinated if they've already had it twice? Does it provide any benefit at all? I mean, it's...
Well, that on that point, we don't know. And I think we have to be honest about that. We have to say, look, I don't know.
I guess
talking about the kids that are, like, young infants who we know are almost certainly... naive to the virus. But no, it's a different story. If you have a 9-year-old who's had it 3 times, I don't know. Is there any benefit? I have no idea.
Right.
You've had
Omicron, but I'll give you a vaccine to the variant 3 before this.
Yeah.
So I think what Kurt's fear is like everything in media or everywhere where people are getting information, they're coming in, I already know this, I've heard about it. Well, where have you heard about it? Is that really good information? And are we giving it a sort of a stamp of approval imprimatur? Yes, you all need this because, and I don't think putting a necessary barrier in, I don't know what the solution is, but it's like, are we benefiting the populace by just saying, yeah, well, CDC said, go ahead, do it. Yes, everyone should get it. I guess I don't really believe that. I don't believe that every child who's had it before needs to get it. Or they could, but again, we don't have long-term data. When do you want it? And although there are, you know, vaccines did roll out a long time ago, how many times have we had a full national push? Probably with polio if we had it.
Yeah.
I mean, during the pandemic.
That's probably the best example.
But once, I mean, here where the pandemic, it's still going around, but again, it's not the same now. I mean, you can see people walking around. And governments can push things, but for the most part, societies respond to pandemics and other infections based on pretty reasonable, they look around, see what is around. You didn't have to ask people to get vaccinated first because they see people getting sick, they get vaccinated. As soon as the disease starts to get less severe and they start seeing people not, they say, hey, you know, maybe I won't. And that's all completely reasonable on a population basis. And I think we're kind of past that emergency stage, and I would like to see, is there really an emergency right now to push 5-year-olds to 5-month-old, like a 5-month-old to get a vaccine, or would it be reasonable to, hey, let's actually get some data. Does it actually stop them from getting illness? Let's get some more longer-term data. Why are we pushing a vaccine out and using IgG levels as our endpoint? I mean, basically to get it out quickly. I guess I have some qualms with that.
Well, some of the things that parents ask me about, you know, do you think I should get my kid vaccinated? Because from everything they've read and looked at, that the especially the younger kids, is caseload and deaths are virtually non-existent. I mean, down around the 1% level. And a lot of states that have released information, mainly through people who've gotten the FOIA Act there, in their health departments that, you know, I had one I was looking at here this week there from Massachusetts. I didn't realize that they had 7 million people in that small state, but in the birth 15-year-olds, in the first year, they had one death, and that was in a 10-month-old. And in the second year, they had, 4 or 5 deaths from birth to 15. But, you know, the caseload and the death load is virtually non-existent.
Well, what's our death rate right now in the county? Like about 1 a week? Or?
No.
No, this is more for children.
No, I'm just kind of, where are we currently in Madison County?
We've seen a tremendous positive.
No, not positive.
As far as mortality rate goes, it's really been
like
very, very low.
How many deaths have we had over the past month? I mean, because again, I'm just
looking
at what I see.
There's been 2 reported deaths in the month of June.
And that's among adults. Or you know, among, that's including adults and the really high susceptibility.
Yeah.
So, I mean, compared to like
30, 40.
Actually, we shouldn't really have discussion with folks who are visiting. Sorry.
Yeah. No, but I think, the more discussion with your medical home, the better. I mean, absolutely, I completely agree with that. And, you know, it's one of those things that it always behooves people to, have those discussions. And the health department really is good about referring, their clients to primary providers. They've always done that. And so I think that's great. And now we'll have more opportunities to do it now that the restrictions are lifted and stuff like that. So,
Kurt, are you satisfied?
I think we've had a very robust discussion.
Very good.
And that's exactly, I think, what our health advisory committee. I'm astounded, as I think Fred mentioned, from the back bench, that that's a very high level. I think our medical professionals here go to another level. It's really amazing to listen to, and I think that is going to be benefiting us a tremendous. And that this will be. This information will be provided to our health committee, which meets on
Friday.
What information?
Just kind of this discussion. So, they'll be interested in listening. This discussion is for our county board to listen to. And
so are you bringing this to the health department committee?
I think the discussion we had here was a lot more important than that.
I agree. I'm asking because we need to get an agenda, set. So that's the reason I was asking. Is there some action that you were hoping to consider or have the health department committee consider?
I did talk to chairman of the health committee, Mike Babcock, a little bit. I think he was, I'm just looking at my notes here. Yeah, I think he's looking for information, just looking for guidance on this. And I think that because the vaccines now have been offered to the children under 5, I think that has been something that a lot of folks are quite interested in.
I couldn't agree more. I'm going to just point this out. We have two pediatricians sitting at the table, and if it were me with my child, talking with you, I get the sense that you would not recommend it. If it was my child talking with you, I get a sense that you would recommend it. And ultimately, it's going to be the parent that's going to make the choice.
Yeah.
And so I just beg, let's not make this any more confusing for the consumer and for the parent in that sense. And what it is that we do at the health department. We provide the service. That's it, and we do it with integrity and knowledge that certainly we don't bring people, there without their intent of wanting to have the service that's performed. So, I mean,
but Tony, I would say that informed consent in this country is so important.
I don't disagree with you at all.
And I think I think we're just concerned that with just one drumbeat of in the media, which is not that we're concerned that people really should have a full-bodied informed consent.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I would hope that any good parent is made that decision with their healthcare provider to be able to do it, but. In the same breath, the only issue at hand is the fact that we provide the service. That's
it. That's what I'm kind of wondering about. What does that have to do with what the health department?
Yeah, that's sort of what I was trying. But it doesn't.
Because what I saw in Collinsville, and it was in January, February, it was a cattle call. It was folks that were totally in fear, actually in fear, and they were not looking for information. They just wanted the shot. And the mainstream media was saying, safe and effective, fear, get the shot. And I think we're beyond that. I think it's time to consult, get back to the physician, to seek and take time. It's a big decision for little children. Is it going to have long-term implications? This is a new technology that has been introduced to this nation and the world via an emergency use authorization. And I think parents, I think the now it's time to really think about these things and to get enough information to truly have it. I don't think what the cattle call, what took place in the beginning part of 2021, I don't think that was informed consent. And I think we need to get back to that.
One good thing, I think, Kurt, in relation to your point, we've had a lot of phone calls in our practice. Of course, this is just anecdotal, but we've had a lot of phone calls asking about it. But what I do notice, that there is a tonal shift. There isn't, like, the urgency.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said before, so we're getting questions, but we're not having parents say, all right, I'm in the parking lot.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I knocked out the door. Right. You know, they're just inquiring about
That's
it.
That's a good thing.
And I do. I completely know what you're saying there. And so I do think parents, they are asking questions, and they're, but I don't sense that, you know, I don't know if you've noticed that too, in your practice, that they're just not, like, you know, banging down the doors. They're just like, okay, well, you know, yeah, all right, well, you know, so are you offering it? And if so, they ask the logistical questions or whatever. But yeah, I haven't had anyone who's just been very, very upset that they can't do it, you know, same day or next day or something like that. So I'm hoping that yeah, we're having more deliberative, you know, and kind of parents are, I think they're just naturally more cautious with babies anyway. I mean, I think we all are.
That's true.
You know, they want to ask more questions and they, all of that. So, but I have noticed that for what it's worth. And it's just anecdotal. It's just one person. But I that's definitely been a difference.
And it has been incorporated at the health department as just an additional service provided. We're not doing anything in a mass clinic type of formation or anything like that. I mean, those vaccines are available. We have Moderna Monday. That you can get, if you're wanting Moderna, we set that up on Monday. That's for a lot of reasons why we only do one vaccine at a time. But we're seeing clients for a lot of other reasons as well that don't have anything to do with COVID. So it's being set up during our normal clinic operations. There's nothing beyond that, you know, that's happening. So I think that intensity, if you will, that is gone. That does not exist anymore. And
I just don't see why the health department would make a recommendation to people. I mean,
well, because,
you know, there's
they
disagreement
want to make sure that people are healthy
from this committee. So, I mean, I think that, you know, whoever's making the CDC or whoever would be the one that people would be looking at. I don't know that that the health department is in position to make a recommendation as to what people should do.
Well, just simply like, for any medication you see an advertisement on TV, before you see, just consult your doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of the same thing. It basically just saying,
yeah,
we haven't studied this. We're not putting our, you know, just like, uh-huh, discuss with your.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And I kind of think we do that. And we've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
So.
I think the informed consent was maybe better at the very beginning. I took it the first day. I knew there was very little in the way behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Judge, I'm like, do I want to take it? Don't I? I'm 50, 53. I'm in the hospital. I'm probably going to get it. Okay, it's mRNA. I was a little naive. There's some complications with the mRNA vaccine that I did not really appreciate at the time. It's not as simple as what it was, but you know, I was okay with that. But I guess I've been a little disillusioned with the rigor and the, I don't know, lack of bias in the whole process that's gone through, and I'd like to see it kind of return to a more normal role. And as a physician and a PhD who actually does microbiology or did, I'd actually like to be able to get some of the data and not have it be, well, we're going to hold this for 75 years. Doesn't exactly inspire confidence. And again, that's not science. It's, you publish. You don't say, I'm an expert. Here's the result. So,
well, let's hope this doesn't happen for another 100 years, and
oh.
By then we'll have some data on this one, so we can.
Tony, I'm going to miss your attention. I'm going to miss that so much. I missed Helen Hawkins, and I know Helen's not.
Kurt, you can't put a picture of me up here. I already told you.
apply. I think it would look great.
I think it's a good idea. We have a motion right on that.
Any other comments or anything?
No, I have to go.
Yeah. If not, need a motion to adjourn.
I'll motion to adjourn.
Okay. Second. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. And then, Tony, you're not going to be here, but the next meeting won't be in July, then we'll be in August?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, it'll be the first Tuesday of August.
Okay.